Hello and welcome to the Flight Free podcast, the place for uplifting stories, grounded adventures, and enlightening reasons why not to fly. For the next 25 minutes, we hope to inspire, inform, and entertain. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride.
Hello and welcome to the Flight Free podcast. I'm Bertie.
And I'm Maggie.
And in this episode, we're going to be exploring the links between climate change and the coronavirus pandemic. We're going to be talking to Dr. Shatta Chakraborty, a behavioural scientist known for her work on communicating about risk and behaviour relating to the COVID-19 pandemic and to climate change. Maggie, have you got this month's Flight Free Fact?
Flight Free Fact.
The coronavirus pandemic started in January 2020. By April 2020, 3 months after the start of the pandemic, air travel was down 90% compared with the same month in 2019. As of June 2021, air travel is still 60% down compared with June 2019, and international travel is down 81%. The impact of the pandemic on air travel is clear. What's less well understood is the impact the travel has had on the spread of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's been a difficult year for our campaign because although those drops in air traffic are beyond our wildest dreams, our campaign's always been about choosing not to fly. This year, the choice has been taken away from us. However, on the upside, many British people are enjoying a UK-based holiday this year. But the challenge is many people are yearning for the freedom to travel. What effect will that have on flying when restrictions are lifted?
Let's talk about this with our guest. Welcome, Shatta. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your work?
Yes, well, your accents are making me quite nostalgic. I spent many years in the UK. I did my PhD in risk management. And then I went on from finishing my PhD looking at how behavioral science can really be applied to patient decision-making. So why don't patients make the best decisions around their healthcare regimes despite their doctor's instructions? And so I was fascinated by that discrepancy between patient perception and best outcomes and why patients wouldn't make the best outcomes despite all of the knowledge and data and evidence. And so that then rolled into my postdoctorate, which I did at Oxford University at the Center for Sociolegal Studies, and spent two lovely years there, which resulted in a book on pharmaceutical regulation and litigation. Also, so you would think I'd be in healthcare right now, right? But no. So I moved back to the United States. I started teaching at Columbia University, and I was asked to teach a class on carbon sequestration, so behavioral science and carbon sequestration. So I taught at Columbia. I learned more from the students than they might have learned from me. But once you learn about climate change, and once I saw the contribution I could make as a behavioral scientist, because there were parts of climate really related to miscommunication, poor communication, and ultimately behavioral outcomes, I realized that there was a lot of work that needed to be done there, and that's where I should be prioritizing my contribution because it's the biggest crisis that we're facing. And if we have to take time and actually list out the risks we are experiencing as a global collective, nothing beats climate.
Some of the things you said there were really relevant to both the pandemic and to climate change, the things about science and behavior. You've said that we must treat climate change and the pandemics as interconnected threats. Could you tell us a bit more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, so even when I was studying patient behavior, I realized that there's a cognitive response that is relevant regardless of whether we're thinking about decision-making, about our individual decision-making, or we're thinking about how we engage with the environment, or we're thinking about how we engage with wider communities. Our brain processes information in very similar ways, and different risks are processed in very similar ways that are really predictable, that are not aligned to any sort of rational outcomes. And that's not something that we should be hard on ourselves for. It's just the way our brains are wired. And so I realized that this is something that we are actually not applying, not just to patient decision-making, but also to how we think about climate. And one thing we're definitely not applying it to is infectious disease, another huge risk that is being amplified because of two major trends, which is the planet warming and overpopulation. So these two things together is resulting in the increased frequency and probability of disease outbreaks occurring. And I'll get into some of that. And I'll also get into why infectious diseases are spreading outside of the ones that are existing already, why they're spreading outside of where they have historically been contained, which is the lower latitudes. I'm talking about diseases like malaria or chikungunya, or these things that the higher latitudes have not been as concerned about because these are more tropical diseases. But as the planet is warming, there are now habitats that are more amenable to these diseases spreading and being available there. So that's one way that the planet warming is resulting in infectious disease outbreaks going further and wider. But really what I'm fascinated by is zoonotic disease transfer and new emerging diseases that persist. So emerging and persistent infectious diseases that originate in animals, which is about 75% of the pandemics in recorded human history. That's how they have come into being. And so what happens is animals and humans are finding themselves interacting in ways that have never happened necessarily in the past because of an increasing population, because of deforestation, because of habitat infiltration and destruction, because of increased consumption and demand for animal products and exotic products. And so now we're finding, because of human demand and really bad human behaviors, we're putting like animals that would never be in an environment together, forcefully together, which is creating these fertile breeding grounds for viruses to emerge and to mutate, and then to jump from animal to human, and then human to human transmission, and then bang, COVID-19, or who knows what next. It's just asking for it. I don't like using the word natural because what does natural really mean? But when you're experimenting with nature like that, you are creating again scenarios that we haven't had, which is increasing the likelihood of something unexpected to emerge. And that's really what happened with COVID-19. That's the story of COVID-19. Just like it's the story of HIV, just like it's the story of Nipah virus in Bangladesh and Malaysia, MERS from the Arabian Peninsula, swine flu, bird flu. These are all zoonotic diseases. And so ultimately, with the planet warming, with overpopulation, with bad human behaviors, and with cognitive limitations that we have, which again is evident in individual patient decision making all the way to how we engage with the environment, this is how all of these things really intertwine.
So following on from that, as a behavioral scientist, what do you think the pandemic has shown us about how people behave in a crisis? And is there anything we can learn from the pandemic that would help us to tackle climate change?
Yes, absolutely. As a behavioral scientist, what I'm seeing in response to the outbreak of the pandemic is unfortunately what I saw in response to the outbreak of swine flu and bird flu. We have had a lot of these learnings for many decades, but not much has been applied. And that's why the policy component of this comes in, because it's really hard to get funding to proactively prepare for an infectious disease outbreak. It's not politically expedient. It's not a popular thing to do, or to create a budget for something that is invisible, that seems really far in the future. So you're talking about an invisible microorganism that may not even show up for a few days because it's incubating. And we're trying to somehow stop that from traveling around this unbelievably connected, fast moving global world. There's no way that we can stop it from doing damage once it's out. And we don't want to be playing relief and recovery. We don't want to be trying to run and catch up to the disease once it's already out. What we know as behavioral scientists is that people are extremely complacent when an outbreak isn't occurring, and people panic once an outbreak does occur. So we know that if something is invisible or seemingly low probability or perceived as far away or not happening for a while, like infectious disease, like climate change, right? People aren't concerned about sea level rise. It's not very sexy. It's slow moving. It's like, oh great, the water is rising like millimeter by millimeter. The implications of that are incredible, but it doesn't really register in terms of how our brains think about risk and process risk.
So how do you think scientists performed at communicating about the coronavirus pandemic? And do you think that they could do better when it comes to climate change?
Oh, yes. This has gotten me in trouble with fellow scientists. But there's a few things that are going on here. So one, it's not exactly the scientists' fault. The scientists are not incentivized by academic institutions to communicate to the public. It doesn't get you further in your career necessarily. It doesn't give you tenure. And why would you spend time communicating your research when the goal is really to get it into peer-reviewed academic journals, which will be published 6 months or a year after your research, and then you're already moving on to the next research effort Again, none of which stipulates that anything needs to be communicated to the public. That is left for journalists or other middlemen to fill that vacuum so that the information, the research gets out to those who need it. That's changing, thank goodness. I'm noticing that those who are doing their PhDs after me have communications training as part of their career trajectory. And I'm seeing a lot more research grants are requiring communications be part of the end product. So not just the primary research, not the, just the journal articles, but communication efforts to the public and others. So that has been recognized and it's changing. We also have to remember climate scientists have had a massive disinformation campaign against any efforts that they have made, which is the fossil fuel industry truly putting in an inordinate amount of money to spread disinformation. And so there's a distinction between misinformation and disinformation I should make here. Misinformation is just incorrect information or people receiving information, interpreting it wrong, what have you. That's misinformation. Disinformation is active push out of incorrect facts and data and evidence so as to nefarious in ways, so as to meet an end goal. And so the fossil fuel industry has really campaigned and put out disinformation in a way that has been truly, truly harmful. And so that's something that the scientists have had to not only deal with, but try and overcome. And now here's where scientists have fared poorly, is that if they had actually collaborated and had messaging that was consistent as a scientific body, they might have been able to go a little bit further in pushing back against the disinformation. But the problem is the public is hearing all these inaccurate facts from oil and gas for decades. And then you have scientists that are fighting with each other over decimal points, even though scientists broadly agree. What the public hears is really strong messaging, disinformation, nefarious communications from oil and gas, and from the scientists who genuinely are trying to make an effort to communicate to the public, but are creating this scientific pluralism. Now you have a public that is like, I just don't believe any of them. I can't trust the scientists because they're arguing with each other. And so they must not know what they're talking about, despite that not being true. But here's a really strong, aggressive commercial saying how great Exxon is. It really doesn't matter exactly what the sea level rise amount is going to be. It's going to happen and we know it's going to be bad. So let's stop fixating on details like that and let's actually support one another as a science community and push forward a message that is truly consistent. That'll come a long way in correcting for misinformation and fighting disinformation.
Very, very interesting rundown. On a slightly different angle, what part do you think overpopulation has played in triggering this pandemic? And do you think it plays an equal part in climate change, or would consumption or economic forces be more significant?
Right. So I would say that it comes down to consumption, but overpopulation is resulting in increased consumption. And it's not any particular country necessarily, because obviously specific countries are reducing in birth rate, but we're increasing as a global populace to 10 billion people by 2050. And with that comes a net greater demand for food products. We have to increase agricultural production to feed 10 billion people on the planet by something like 70%. And that is a huge strain on our effort to reduce energy emissions. We're talking about needing to overhaul agriculture as one of the top polluting industries. Food and agriculture, along with fashion and the heavy industries like steel, cement, obviously aviation, these are going to be where we need to target our attention. But rather than thinking through how we're going to overhaul food and agriculture, we're thinking through how to increase food production by 70% by 2050 because of the increasing number of people on this planet. So I ask people to remember, when we talk about overpopulation, we're talking about the global population, not any one particular country. And we have to think about the food and agricultural system as a global system to feed our global population. And food and agriculture as a global system is truly one of the top priorities in terms of identifying where we can make the biggest dent in reducing our carbon emissions. So that's why that is such a challenge.
This question is specifically about aviation. It's pretty clear that aviation played a huge part in spreading COVID-19 at the beginning of the pandemic. Do you think that in a future pandemic, we should act to reduce international travel more quickly? Or do you think that there's too high a cost to doing that?
So I think it's unrealistic to think that people won't travel. So it's better decisions for those who will travel. And obviously, we also are now able to use Zoom and other technologies to be able to connect when not required to physically travel. And so we have to be practical and realistic in terms of how we're going to think about travel and the necessity of travel for people's lives and livelihoods. One thing that wasn't considered as part of the risk model was the secondary and tertiary impacts of the lockdowns around COVID-19. So there were primary lives lost. Of course, that's easy to model comparatively. But if you think about the years of life lost because of economic hardships associated with inability to work, inability to travel, inability to export, import, whatever, that is something that hasn't truly been modeled out in any way that is satisfying for somebody like me. So I want to see what were the secondary impacts, what were the tertiary impacts of the policies that were put in place around protecting people against the primary impact, which is fatalities around COVID-19. But what about the years of life lost? What about the economic harms that occurred? And those are things that at the same time, it's a complex interconnected challenge. And so if we think about how much travel positively impacted the environment, it positively impacted transmission of COVID-19, but it very negatively impacted people's livelihoods, I should say. And so where is the model? And I don't have this yet for you all, but maybe we can reconnect when some of this data comes through, because it's a lot. But I'm really curious to see what it looks like in terms of shutting down travel and the negative impacts that has also had, just in terms of years of lives lost.
And how did your life change during the pandemic? Have there been any or many positives for you?
Yeah, I think some of the trends that were already underway accelerated because of the pandemic. So it's fascinating to look at how people are working more from home, and that the mental health implications there, the fact that there's better work-life balance and that people are going to want that and demand that going forward. So that is something that was already kind of happening, but accelerated. So it's accelerated more distributive working across the spectrum. And I think that's a huge positive that reduces the amount of travel. And again, some travel is always going to exist, but unnecessary travel, like the we don't have time group that I work with, that I work full-time for, is a no-fly organization and a no-fly conference. So I have personally been working pre this pandemic, during this pandemic, fully remote, fully distributive. The team is based in Stockholm, Sweden, the headquarters, and I'm here in Washington, D.C. We've never actually met each other, but we had very little to change and pivot in our work model because of COVID-19. We were able to continue to do exactly what we were doing because we have a no-fly policy unless it's absolutely necessary. And so I think we're going to see much more of that, which is obviously positive for people's mental health, people's work-life balance, and for the planet, definitely. But will that get rid of transportation completely? No. Do we need things like green hydrogen and retrofitting of commercial and private aviation? Absolutely. And it was really nice to see that the possibility is there to be able to reduce carbon emissions at a global scale, but at what cost, right? So that is something that, again, we need to model out and understand. And it's also having 1 year of reduced carbon emissions globally is like not smoking one cigarette on your path to lung cancer. So taking 2020 out of the equation of our runaway climate change trajectory did not do anything, given that 2021, we're bouncing right back and our global emissions are higher than ever. So it's good to see that we can stop it, but we don't need COVID-19 or something that is this catastrophic to have the public wake up and recognize that we can have cleaner air just because we paused for a hot second. We don't need something catastrophic to tell us that. We need to work consistently every single day and together to take the steps and measures we need in terms of science, in terms of technology, and in terms of our behavioral changes to really address this huge challenge that we all collectively face. There's no magic bullet, and COVID-19 by no means, if anything, it showed that we can definitely change behavior and pause, but by no means was that anything more than one day of not smoking.
Thank you, Shatha. Those were all our questions, and you've answered them brilliantly and very fully. It's been a really exciting conversation. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
Okay, now let's talk about our destination of the month.
Destination of the month.
I was really interested in what Shatha was saying about the way humanity interacts with nature. And there are not many places in England, well, in the UK really, but especially England, where human influence isn't obvious in the landscape. But I grew up in Aberystwyth in Wales. And I remember back in the 90s when red kites were a really, really rare bird. And they'd been persecuted almost to extinction, but there were still a few left in Wales. And we used to go on these pilgrimages to the town dump where you could sometimes see red kites picking over the rubbish, but I never ever saw one. And now there's a feeding project in Aberystwyth, a forest centre called Bulk Matararian, and you can go any day of the week and you can see scores of red kites circling to get their meat, which comes from one of the local butchers. It's an amazing sight. But it's not just in Wales anymore. And a few days ago, I was at the White Horse Hill in Oxfordshire, where there's this 3,000-year-old horse carved into the chalk escarpment. Fortunately, it's not very visible at the moment because it's got lots of green stuff growing over the chalk, but it's still an amazing work of art. And we were standing on this hill and there was a red kite really close to us that was just catching the updraft on the escarpment. And they're so stunning to watch because of the way they adjust their wings and tail to just keep still in the updraft. It's still very exciting to see them now, even though they're almost numerous again. How about you, Bertie? Have you got something you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate recently to go down to Cornwall, where I go every year down near Penzance, and I've gone there every year for the last 15 years or so and never seen a dolphin. But this year I saw one on one day and then saw about 30, 40 or so on another day, swimming around, feeding, kind of doing everything you want them to be doing. That was kind of about as exciting an encounter as I think I'll ever have with any wildlife. And yeah, it was amazing to see with the backdrop of the Cornish coast.
Where were you? Were you on land or were you on a boat?
I was on a boat, so it was kind of even more amazing being like nearby and not too nearby, following them around for a bit and seeing what they do. They were just all over the place and would swim over every now and then, sort of say hello and pop off. That was an unbelievable experience. Really nice to see something that I've always wanted to see.
So that was Destination of the Month. I think that's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you very much to our wonderful guest, Shatha.
And see you next time, where we'll be talking about voluntourism.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for your company at this Flight Free podcast episode. We hope you enjoyed the journey. You can find out more about the campaign at our website, flightfree.co.uk, or find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Flight Free UK. Until next time, stay grounded.